None of these stories rings true with any of the men who served with him. This latter tale even contradicts his later claim in Cash, the autobiography, that I've done no direct physical violence to people. An assault on two military policemen would have resulted in a serious investigation followed by demotion or a dishonorable discharge if found guilty. The story of brawling with a paratrooper seems out of character for a man chiefly distinguished for abstemiousness and a peace-loving nature. Everyone who knew Cash points out that whereas it was almost expected that red-blooded American teenagers would go wild on their nights off, Cash distinguished himself with his self-control. We would all go to German guest houses and have a few beers, remembers Chuck Riley. If we were drinking in Landsberg, John would come with us. He would joke and do what the rest of us were doing, but if any of us felt like chasing ladies, John would just sit at the table and have another beer. Similarly, no one can remember Cash's threatening to pistol whip a lieutenant in Italy, another act of subordination that would have seen him court-martialed, or hurling his typewriter through a window when he got frustrated during a particularly difficult shift at Landsberg. The absence of windows in the work area makes this story difficult to believe. Many times in his writing, Cash appears to embellish basic facts to make his story more compelling. For instance, he told Christopher Wren that a school friend had put a pencil in his left ear, which caused his abnormally acute hearing. 4 years later, in Man in Black, he suggests the incident occurred while in the service. The school friend morphs into a German girl, and instead of abnormally acute, his hearing becomes temporarily impaired. Rather than showing signs of a bad memory, the embellishments suggest a tendency to add danger and intrigue to otherwise mundane events. As one of his producers would later say of him, John never let the truth get in the way of a good story. While he was, in fact, at Landsberg on March 5, 1953, the day Joseph Stalin died, his comment in Cash, the autobiography, that I was who they called when the hardest jobs came up. I copied the first news of Stalin's death, brings a wry smile to the faces of those who worked with him. That's nonsense, says one. He didn't understand Russian, and if it came in code, we wouldn't have been able to decipher it anyway. It created a certain aura about his skill that, in my view, was directly related to his celebrity. I don't know if something like the fight could have happened, but if it had, it would have caused a lot more rumor, discussion, and discipline, says Rich Collins. You don't ever hit an air policeman. I don't even remember him having a reputation that way. He wasn't a renegade. He never tested the limits. A controversial incident that really would have brought Cash shame was either forgotten or left out. One weekend he was in the town of Augsburg on a weekend pass. He and a couple of friends got blasted on German beer and cognac and went to a strip club. The colleague he went with says only, I have a couple of good stories about what happened in Augsburg, but I wouldn't want to tell them to you. The story he doesn't want to tell is well known among others who served in the 12th RSM. John was walking down the sidewalk with this friend of mine, says one of them, and he saw a black soldier with a white German girl. He was so incensed that he used profanity to say that a black guy was trying to have sex with a white woman, and that this wasn't the way it should be. The guy who was with Cash had to pacify and restrain him, and in the end, MPs came and calmed him down. They told him that while this might not go on where he lived back home, he had to lay off or else he would be in big trouble. That was an incident that stuck with me. I had never seen him being racist back on the base. Ours was an integrated unit. There was probably a black guy for every four white guys. Probably a combination of the drink and Cash's cultural heritage led to the incident. Not only did he hail from what was then one of the most racist states in America, but he came from a town where the only African-American anyone can remember worked as a janitor. What he saw in Germany, black GIs dating white German girls, was a totally new and shocking experience for him. His old school friend A.J. Henson says that they were all racist at the time. They considered African-Americans to be almost a different breed to themselves and never knew any as friends. Henson can recall stepping aside to let an African-American pass by on a sidewalk in Memphis when the friend he was with from Dias rebuked him for doing such a thing for anyone who was only a nigger. Throughout his books, Cash claimed that his level of religious commitment decreased during his time in Germany, but his friends remember him regularly attending the Protestant chapel on the base. They allow that he may eventually have changed his habits, but more likely because of the nature of the shifts and the days off. I can't remember hardly a Sunday that John was not in church, says Bob Whitaker, one of his roommates. In basic training, he was in church all the time. As far as I knew, it never tapered off. He was someone who didn't get carried away with his beliefs, but I don't think he had any doubt as to where he stood. He was very obviously a Christian, says Rich Collins. He was fundamental, decent, and Baptist. I assume that there was a moral code behind the fact that he didn't go whoring and drinking like the other guys. Ben Perea, who roomed with Cash at Landsberg, remembers that he would pray each day and lay on his bunk reading his Bible. He would always express his faith, he says. I would do my prayers, and he would do his meditation. He would meditate for what seemed like a lot longer than my prayers. He would just close his eyes and be very quiet. I can still picture him meditating very deeply, and then he would go back to his guitar and start singing. Music had asserted its place in Cash's life almost as soon as he arrived at the base in Germany. He didn't have a record player, but would listen to the Armed Forces Network and, late at night, could even tune a high-powered receiver into American domestic radio stations to listen to the Grand Ole Opry broadcast live from Nashville. Very few men of the 12th RSM in the early 1950s liked all types of popular music. Those from the cities of the North and East liked cool jazz and swing and considered artists like Hank Snow too crude, simple, and sentimental. On the flip side, those from southern towns and farming communities liked country and gospel and found Stan Kenton too complicated and disorganized. Cash fell in with a group of fellow country boys whose idea of a good time was to hang out in the basement with their musical instruments for picking sessions. Rich Collins thought of them as footlocker guys, the kind of guys who, if they weren't working, would play cards, do music, or socialize in small groups, as opposed to the traveling types who looked for pleasure in the cities, or the jocks who played competitive sports. Ben Perea, Ted Freeman from West Virginia, Orville Rigdon from Louisiana, and Reed Cummins from Arkansas made up the original core of pickers. When Ben Perea left the 12th RSM in 1953, he was replaced by Bill Carnahan from Missouri. Except for Perea, who only sang, they were all more accomplished musicians than Cash. Freeman played a mean mandolin, but he could also play fiddle and banjo and had perfect vocal pitch. Carnahan boasted the best voice and could finger-pick beautifully on guitar. Eventually, Rigdon accompanied Cash into Landsberg and helped him choose a 25 Deutschmarks guitar. Returning to the basement, he and Carnahan then had to teach John the rudiments that he had last been taught by Jesse Barnhill. "I had to show him basic chords," remembers Rigdon. "Then he would start to sing. His key was usually E or A." This informal group is frequently referred to as the Landsberg Barbarians, but if Orville Rigdon's memory's right, they only once played outside the barracks as part of a fundraiser on the base for United Way, and it's unlikely they ever formally adopted a name. If they were known as the Landsberg Barbarians, then it wasn't, as some commentators have speculated, because they acted wildly in the local bars and taverns, but as a playful reference to the biweekly base newspaper, the Landsberg Bavarian. The picking sessions gave Cash the stimulus he needed to learn to play guitar and even to begin to write songs. The fact that they didn't perform in public, other than for interested onlookers from the 12th RSM, meant that Cash's music education took place in the context of friendship, respect, and a mutual love of music. The other guys had been brought up playing music, and they taught him, says Bob Whitaker. Like anything else, it takes practice and hard work. The music they played was a combination of the popular songs of the time and old favorites that they'd grown up singing on farms, ranches, and cotton fields. Bill Carnahan remembers Cash singing the cowboy song "One More Ride," written by Bob Nolan of the Sons of the Pioneers. Ben Perea remembers harmonizing with Cash on the bluegrass classic "Beautiful, Beautiful Brown Eyes" and the spiritual "Were You There When They Crucified My Lord?" Their collective musical heroes included Jimmie Rodgers, Hank Snow, Roy Acuff, Ernest Tubb, and, inevitably, Hank Williams. Hank Williams' music combined elements of folk, blues, and gospel, and the story he told usually involved someone who could be alternately hard-living and repentant. Hank sang with a poignant sadness in his voice, and yet at the same time the listener sensed that he enjoyed the misery for the dangerous edge it gave his life. He drank to drown his sorrows and then felt sorry that he'd been drunk. During Cash's time in Germany, Hank was at the peak of his recording career. In 1951, he released "Cold, Cold Heart" and "Hey, Good Lookin'." In 1952, he released "Honky Tonk Blues," "Half as Much," "Jambalaya," and "Setting the Woods on Fire." The papers widely reported Williams' errant lifestyle, which would become the template for the post-war country music star. Country stars came from poor backgrounds, and as they acquired wealth, they would often use it ostentatiously. Once they'd reached the top of the charts, they'd become addicted to alcohol or drugs and carry on a series of tempestuous relationships. Hank Williams died in the back of a car while being driven to a gig on New Year's Day 1953. AFN had the story right away, remembers Jack Matheson. That was the hardest moment of John's life in Germany. He went into a depression for the rest of the day.